Hi there, it's Atul here. I'm very, very excited about today's live stream. We've got an excellent panel here. We're doing a superb job in our social distancing. We've got educators here from all over the country, actually. So Cambridgeshire, Hertfordshire, Cumbria, Yorkshire, and London as well. You'll notice there's a lineup change. It's a bit like a music festival or a gig. Things happen, and we have to replace people outside. It's all organic. We're keeping it. All people have stuff going on, family issues. So due to that, we have had a speaker exchange. It's all good. So yeah, let's kick off with so this, just to explain the format, what you have to do is, if you have any questions, just reply to my Twitter account. This video will be live streaming. Just press play on there. I'll be keeping an eye on Periscope, on Twitter, on Facebook, where this is all live streaming. But we'll kick off with a question that Ashton has for Mark. So I'll take it to the floor, Ashton.
This is just for everyone, and you can play along with this at home as you want. Out of just thinking about the GCSE syllabus, which three topics would you add, and which three topics would you drop? So kind of a substitution.
You want me to go first, Ashton?
Anyone.
Okay. Three topics would I drop? So the whole of statistics, the whole of probability, and then I don't know what the other one would be, just whatever the other topic is that Craig Barton really likes. So they can all go, just to wind Craig up as much as I possibly can. What would I add in? I would say, and then to be serious, because GCSE is kind of the end of compulsory for a lot of people. It's the end of the experience of maths that they get. And it breaks my heart that anyone gets to leave schooling, anyone gets to leave a maths education system without being exposed to calculus. So I think I've said this before on other things, the fact you can leave school without ever seeing the true majesty of our subject, that I think that's really upsetting. And it's not that long ago we asked 15-year-olds to do differential equations. These are not beyond pupils to be able to do this. So I'd bring some calculus in that can be, it can be carefully implemented and carefully aligned to what they know and what they don't know at that time. GCSE syllabus is an interesting thing. We have the GCSE specifications from the awarding bodies. But there is no Key Stage 4 national curriculum, never has been, never existed. The national curriculum goes from Key Stage 1 to Key Stage 3. The GCSE is supposed to assess how you did on that curriculum. So I guess I can pick anything from all of Key Stage 1, 2, and 3 as well. Which means I've got another one I'd get rid of. Why the hell is Roman numerals on the primary curriculum? What idiot thought that that was a good idea? The Romans, in the history of maths, you've got great civilizations adding all sorts of stuff to mathematics. The Romans come along, did basically nothing for hundreds of years for our subject, and now they're all our curriculum. Get it off. The only point of Roman numerals on the national curriculum, what, so you can tell what year a soap opera was made when you watch the credits. Just bizarre, bizarre thing. Damn, that was another get rid of. I'd add in multi-base arithmetic throughout the curriculum, because without multi-base arithmetic, you can't really grip what place value means, and you can't really grip what the generalization to algebraic expressions is all about. So I'd add in multi-base arithmetic, and I'd add in explicitly how arithmetic links to algebra. And then I'd probably make, adding in stuff, I'd make something really specific in terms of mathematical modeling. Again, it's that thing of leaving school without ever really, really having experienced mathematics. If you don't do modeling, I think you miss out on quite a lot. And then just to wind Catherine up, I'd chuck a bunch of mechanics into that modeling, just, you
Wow.
know. Yeah, that's what I'd add and remove.
Brilliant, cool. Bernie, would you like to have a go?
Not really. It's not my I agree with Mark, though. Stats, I can't stand. I've never understood it. So I would, that would be the first out into the water for me. And I also agree that calculus is, it was the first part of maths I really fell in love with, and it was so esoteric, and I think everybody should have a taste of it, a sample at least. I agree with those two.
I would add in, I'm adding in some stats because I think that something that's not on the GCSE syllabus that's kind of important is like a running average, so like a running mean. So for instance, it just kind of raised my attention because it's been on the news a lot. They're doing lots of like 5-day means for like death rates and stuff, and people haven't seen. They don't really know what like the running mean is, which is quite kind of interesting because I think it's not really a difficult concept, and it makes a lot of sense coming from like the start mean in like key stage two. So I don't think it would be a big addition, and I think it's something that's probably quite important that the average person on the street knows about.
Yeah, I think I'd agree with that. It's on the stats GCSE, and time series is on the normal GCSE exams, and they kind of sit hand in hand, so it almost feels like you're missing something out when you don't cover it. I'm trying to think of things that I've taught in like further maths and A-level that I've kind of felt like I missed, because I've moved into a setting where I'm only teaching up to 16 now. I did further maths this year, and the thing, that calculus element, the kind of teaching them differentiation for the first time, it was amazing. Kind of being able to do that with a set of students who I'd known for quite a long, like the whole year, and known that they were capable of doing it was really lovely. They also really liked matrices because it looks like it's going to be very, very difficult and actually is quite nice. And there's probably a whole bunch of applications that they'll use that in if in future jobs that they never really considered before. I mean, I would have said probably drop everything in mechanics when I was younger, but I actually do think that I actually genuinely do agree with Mark. I think that actually if I'd have seen some sort of modelling like that when I was younger, when I got to A level, I wouldn't have been so averse to it, and I wouldn't have kind of hated it as much as I did. And but I'm a statistician at heart, so I agree with kind of, there's a lot of stats that I did post 16 that I don't think I could really pinpoint the bits in particular, but bringing a lot more of that down to make it applicable and less kind of just airy-fairy with just calculating averages and that's all we do. We sometimes plot stuff on a graph and then compare it, but what does it really mean? Kind of more of that application of stats might be nice as well in kind of a modelling kind of way. That's why we do it.
Would you add in standard deviation too?
I think it's too cumbersome to kind of deal with at the level that they're at. So even when it's on the stats GCSE, it takes so much time to calculate things like standard deviation and things that in the way that it's set up in an exam that it's not worth it. But if we could do it in a way that meant they could use technology and kind of understand the underpinnings of it, but something else dealt with, and it was some of all of the X squareds for them, when you've got ridiculously large numbers, that might be a lot nicer.
Okay, cool.
I think I should maybe out myself a bit here, just to clear things up. I actually love statistics a lot. I think it is its own discipline, and I would have statistics as a course. And maybe at that teenage sort of level, because the thing about calculating standard deviations on that mechanistic thing, I'm not particularly that interested in that. And what if we presented them with standard deviations and it's more about interpretation? And, you know, if you look at the adult population's ability to critically analyze what the media says to them, it's not good. And it's hugely important that it is good, because otherwise we end up in a rather dark place. If people can't hold to account the media, hold to account government, hold to account, you know, important bodies. So I love stats, actually. I just don't think it belongs in a pure maths course.
I think the other side of kind of the argument for maybe putting something like that in any form of kind of curriculum for 16 and under would be that I wouldn't necessarily want my students spent two lessons doing standard deviation in stats, because it takes a long time to figure out what it means and then to actually physically go through a table and do those calculations. But it, like I said before, if we could set it up in a way that used the technology, they're actually almost learning another skill as well. They're learning how to use technology in a mathematical way, in a way to analyze things for themselves. And that, I think, is probably the biggest thing that's missing in the GCSE, maybe, because in A-level they've tried to bring that in, and even there that's difficult to pull it together. So maybe you're right, having it as something separate and bring all of those elements together might be a nice way to tie it all in.
Yeah, I think it could be interesting. I'd be really interested, Bernie, in what you know, so like it's Ashton's question, so we can probably just ignore it, right? So
definitely,
you made it about GCSE, but I'd be really interested in what you think is missing from early years, Bernie. What are we not getting right there? What sort of things should we be doing, or the stuff that we should be removing, you know? And those are such careful questions. Like, doesn't it boggle the mind that some people sat around on an advisory group, some people sat around at the DfE and said, you know, the early learning goals, we can probably remove shape and space from that. Isn't that mental? I mean, what group did that? What group sat there and thought, yeah, the learning of early number has nothing to do with shape and space, does it?
Well, if Helen and Sue Gifford are listening, they might like to join in on that one. No, just incredible, because it shows no understanding of what children should be doing. And if they're focusing on number, then the shape and space has to be in there, because at that age, they're tied together. So it's incredible that anybody would remove that.
Absolutely. How do you communicate? You know, communicating early numberness is one of the hardest things we do. How do you get children to meaning make unless you're using shape and space and metaphor and story and pattern? You know, I find those kind of those little weird decisions pop up, like removing shape and space from early learning goals, adding in Roman numerals to primary. These little odd things. And I think I've got this theory that maybe the DfE just like trolling us, just like occasionally they take the piss so that we have to say, hang on a minute, we're a professional group of people here. And maybe it's just a way of getting us to wake up and say, we're taking back control of curriculum. Who knows? Anyway, I have no idea
what the thinking was behind it, but there's sort of the... I'm not an expert on early years, but I mix with a lot of them, and they're all horrified, and they just can't believe it, and they're up in arms, and quite rightly so. It needs to change.
Yeah. What about you, Atul? What would you...
Yeah, I mean, just reflecting on some of the CPD I've taken, I remember the one I mean, you remember it, of course, because I took it with you, which is this little exercise you do with the Quizenaire ones, where you level the towers. And the idea behind leveling the towers is finding the average. And it's amazing how until GCSE, everyone, well, quite a lot of tutees, students think finding the average is take all the numbers, divide by however many there are. Whereas the idea that it's leveling the towers is, we also learn it later on in A-level maths. And I looked at all the specifications, and the idea that you level the towers, you level everything to make it the same, is actually sitting somewhere deep inside the further maths syllabus. So I thought it was kind of insane that this leveling the towers idea is not taught right from the beginning. And that's, you know, that's something I've changed in my teaching practice. It's become one of my very important things I do with tutees. I've got, you know, 7, 8, 9 year olds, and we get those things and we level the towers. Just that's, you know, that's the sort of thing we can implement. And I know stats is important because we have done it in your CPD day with the mean, mode, median, with those quiz and herods. So
don't tell people I deliver statistics training. I'll be ruined.
It's why we lost Craig Barton. I think we
But they are doing that with block play in nurseries. They're doing leveling, getting things the same height in the comparison. So it's, you can't take that out. It's fundamental. It's the beginning of number.
Yeah, that metaphor of redistribution.
Yeah.
Is so important. And you know, it isn't possible or I don't know any efficient, effective way of communicating that meaningness unless you use metaphor, and unless you use storytelling, unless you use things that really exist to children. You're trying to trying to get them to accept something that's, you know, prima facie is abstract. So unless you use things they can connect to logically, that fit into what they already know, understand, comprehend, then what hope have they got? They're strange things that go on. I noticed that Robot Maths has asked us, I think he's trolling us, he's asked us how else would they understand the title cards on BBC programs. So clearly we do need Roman numerals, because it's the only way that Robot Maths can
excuse me, I'm going to go and read slowly.
Yeah, it's a name after the royals as well, so Henry VIII, and that's another place.
Yeah, I take it all back. I think we should have more Roman numerals on the primary curriculum. Do you do Roman numeral arithmetic? That's interesting.
That's good fun.
Yeah. Oh God, I'm arguing for having it now. Step back. Anyway, sorry.
If anyone's got any questions while we're live streaming, just put them on Twitter and we'll discuss for you. Otherwise, we have a whole bunch of things we could discuss. I know, Catherine, would you like to mention your staff room and what you're doing for teachers to connect on Zoom like this?
So basically every single Thursday, a bunch of us are meeting together on Zoom. We felt a little bit isolated, and lots of people talking about missing talking about maths like we're doing now. Every single Thursday around 4 o'clock, depending on meeting times, I'm hosting just what we're calling lockdown staff room. It's essentially just a place where you can come and just talk about maths and talk about how you're coping with this crazy new type of teaching we're all having to learn how to do, and get ideas from each other. It's been really nice, really, really lovely, just to kind of connect with people on a more personal level. It's been really lovely.
And it just runs on Zoom like this. So you, for those not familiar with Zoom, you install this software and then send the meeting ID, and then we say this exactly the same, because that's what we're using for this live stream as well. So, great. Ashton, you have more questions for us?
Yeah. This is kind of a manipulatives related question. So feel free, anyone, to answer. So if you, because I know obviously Bernie and Mark are big believers in using manipulatives to make sense of the mathematics. Now, say for instance you took over, you started teaching a class in year 10 that hadn't had any experience of manipulatives since Key Stage 1, and they were doing pretty well in terms of attainment and everything like that. Would you still use manipulatives with that class? Like, would you kind of take a step back and take the time to get them familiar with it, to teach things like factorizing quadratics and stuff like that? Or would you say it's almost, not that it's not worth it, but it's kind of the opportunity cost of taking the time to understand and lay the groundwork to be able to successfully make sense of it using manipulatives is kind of, that time could be spent better on other things. Does that make sense to the question?
Mark?
Yeah, it makes sense. In third year undergraduate maths degrees, depending on which courses you've chosen, you might do something like 3D Bernoulli equation and how the fluid dynamics work to create flight. You might do something like how the Lorentz contraction works to show that space and time are varied depending on your relative position and speed. And most people on third year undergraduate degree maths quite like maths, and they're quite into it. But still with them, if I'm teaching the Lorentz contraction, still with them, I will get objects out and we will manipulate it to communicate the meaning of that contraction. So I'm not sure it matters how old someone is or what stage they're at. I think what matters is what meaning making do you want them to achieve? What is it you're trying to communicate to them? And there are lots of different ways of having, particularly a school level maths education system. You can have a school level maths education system that is targeted at, I'm going to give you a paper at the end of year 11, I want you to pass it. And you can do that. It's quite trivial to do that. It's not a particularly difficult thing to do. There's not really much content on school level maths. And there are lots of other models. And maybe at the other end, there's a model of, you're going to be with me for 11 years or 13 years, you know, the schooling system. What I want to achieve at the end of that is you are mathematical, that you can think mathematically, behave mathematically, that you have a sense of meaning and purpose of what's happening in this rather beautiful discipline, and that maybe you'll be excited enough to continue to want to do that in the future. So it's interesting that you said, Ashton, that Bernie and I have this belief in manipulatives. I do believe they exist, right? I've seen them with my own eyes. It's not so much about a belief. It's the right tool for the right time.
Yeah, that was okay. So kind of maybe that's my bad question asking of questions. It's kind of the idea that, so for instance, I've seen you, and I've been to some LaSalle CPD as well, on delivering, introducing students to simultaneous equations with bar models. Now, if those students have not seen a bar model, or they haven't used it to solve equations, or they haven't used it for various other things, then is it going to help them meaning make? Is it the right tool to help them meaning make if they haven't had that journey, if you know what I mean?
Yeah, I would suggest so. Maybe you've seen me do simultaneous equations using a bar model. Ignore the fact it's a bar model. What I was really doing was telling a story. I was telling a story, and I was using a visual metaphor for that story to communicate what these two expressions, equations, to communicate how they're related to each other, what they mean to each other. I remember watching Bernie do a thing on simultaneous. You've got this lovely, it might be year one or something, Bernie, this lovely thing you did with year one with the cups and the counters, which is simultaneous equations. It's really hard for anyone to watch Bernie do that. It's really hard for anyone to come away not understanding what the meaning was. Really hard. So it's just a really powerful way of telling that story as to what these things mean. And I think there's something about, you know, if you look at assimilation and you look at kind of assimilation theory and Piaget and that kind of stuff about how you might acquire new knowledge, there's something really important about new knowledge, novel things you're encountering, being able to logically fit into what you currently know, so that you can assimilate this new knowledge. And, you know, there's a lot of evidence around, if you try to communicate a novel idea and the person you're trying to communicate that with has no way of connecting it to other things they know to be true and believe to be true, then that knowledge is rejected. Those ideas are rejected. So, you know, when you've seen me do that, I don't think I've been using bar modeling. It might be called bar modeling. I've just been using a picture to tell a story, or when I've seen Bernie do it with cups and counters, he's using cups and counters to tell the story. And when you see, I've seen kids respond to that with Bernie, and you see them just go, "I know the answer." Yeah. I know, and not just I know the answers to or whatever, but I know why that is the response I need to give. So, I think it's. I get a lot of people asking me, you know, won't I be wasting time in year 10 if I show them how to use, I don't know, a picture or algebra tile or whatever it is? Well, you will if they don't need that to grip the meaning of it. But if they don't yet have that meaning, you won't be wasting time. It's just a way of communicating the meaning.
Yeah, so you can have all of that. it looks like they've understood it, but actually when you root around and dig around a little bit, they don't fully understand it. So I think it's personally worth spending some time doing that and introducing them. And yeah, there will be some rejection because some will say, I don't need that at all. But at least you tried. I think it's important to do that. I've done that several times with year eights who've looked like they're doing equations very, very well. It's very procedural. But actually, once you throw them pictures, they're lost. They don't know what to do. They don't recognize it's the same thing. So I think it's important that they do see those things and they're making more connections. They have a much deeper understanding of what they're doing. At the same level as a year one can understand those things. It's not difficult, but they often aren't given the opportunity to make those connections. So I would, yeah, I have and do.
Can I just jump in on that from you just saying some of them don't want to do it or some of them will resist it? At the stage that I guess Ashton's talking about, like going into a year 9, 10 class and trying to introduce something they've potentially not seen before like this, you normally have to kind of start more basic than the things that they kind of already feel they know. You have to start at that level of what they already know, show how it works there to make it more complicated. How do you fight the resistance against that? Because for me, a lot of the time it's been, well, I don't need this to do this because I already know how to do it. And that's the biggest hurdle. The kids that haven't done that are the ones that have had the biggest gains from being able to see things by getting the Quiznaire out or drawing a bar model or any kind of diagram to help them. But then the ones that think that they don't need it because I'm cleverer than that. That's the attitude that I think needs to be broken. And
it's not just secondary. You get that if you introduce bar, I mean, this has been going on a while now, but when you first started introducing bar modeling into say year 5 or 6, the kids were very against it. They didn't need to know it. They didn't want to know. So I don't have the answer to that question, but generally I tell teachers, make sure you set them really hard questions that they couldn't possibly do without building a bar model first. So the approach is like that. Hopefully this will work its way through the system. So when they're arriving up in year 10, they will have had some background in this. It's still a journey that's taking place in this country, I think. We're not there yet. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to be said about where motivation comes from. That thing of you face a class and they say, I don't need to use this mess. You know, I can already do this, blah, blah, blah. And like Bernie's saying, so give them a question that is tricky. You know, give them a really hard question. Then do it with whatever manipulative we're talking about, whatever story it is we're talking about. Do it with that and watch them be successful. And there's something about success that drives motivation. And for pupils to overcome a problem, you know, suppose they've got, like Ashton was talking about, simple sense equation, and they've been taught substitution, they've been taught elimination. You give them a question, they can't do it. You show them it with a bar model and they go, all right, yeah, that makes sense. There's something about that, suddenly I'm successful, that motivates you into something else. There's a lot of really nice studies around teachers' preferences for the models that they choose to solve mathematical problems. So if you look at maths teachers, they are massively biased towards solving problems in the abstract and in the symbolic. They go straight for the symbolic. And when you interview pupils, even pupils that are very low attaining, they are also massively biased towards symbolism. And when you dig into that as to why they're massively biased towards symbolism is because, well, that's what the teacher always does. So that must be the grown-up way. That must be the way that is most rewarded to do it in that way. But there's extremely strong data to show that pupils who can communicate across various representations. So if you can describe why this sentence, this story, this picture, this symbolism all mean the same thing, if you can do that multiple representations thing, the evidence and the data is really strong that that leads to far greater long-term retention of those mathematical ideas. Even to the point where some pupils who are behind because they're working more slowly on multiple representations, and then some pupils who are ahead who are just doing symbolism, over time, they overtake them. So, you know, there is, we're interested in that meaning making, we're interested in long-term retention, long-term understanding of mathematical ideas. We do know that multiple representations are super important. It's not just a trick, it's not just a way of making kids feel good or getting something done quickly. It has a massive impact on learning.
Totally agree, Mark. I mean, I do one-on-one work, and it's intervention, and often I get students that are many years behind, or even adult learners. And just to give you like a concrete example or stories, I have this tutee in New York that I've been using these little quizzenaire, the ones with actually, and it's making the rectangles out of, say, six of them. So just to show the factors, 3 times 2. And you know, you see this light bulb moment where this child is several years behind and they're playing with these things. And you know, she just made a 9, made a 3 by 3, and she says, "Oh, it's a square." And you know, that moment when the child kind of looks at you, and she's, "It's a square." And then I say, "Well, that's a square number." And you know, for that child, it's clicked in their head forever. They can make literally a square with those 9 squares. And then the next one came up. She was taking her time, putting them together. And then again, 16 is a square. And I'm working on the abstract as well. So as and when necessary, I switch between the modalities. And you can often get these tutees who are several years behind by these sort of interventions, by changing the modalities and figuring out what they already know. I think you talk about it as an inventive strategy of to try and figure out what the model or metaphor they have in their head is, and try and connect it to their world or what they know so far. I might have adults who are, you know, for them, they've been hearing about percentages, increases, decreases. So the idea of debt and credit. So for them, I can use positive and negative numbers with that metaphor, but I can't use that for younger tutees, for example. So it makes a huge difference. Just keeping an eye on Twitter as well. Just ask us anything. We've got Daniel Wilson on Twitter. Thank you for that question. Afternoon, on the subject of manipulatives, I'm a newbie. Is there anywhere I can go to learn about these and find some resources available for secondary teaching? Who wants to take that?
I must say that LaSalle have a few courses on manipulatives. The LaSalle webinars are really good. Bernie's got a video that he did with Mr. Barton, which was really interesting. I really enjoyed that. And also Pete Mattock's book, I found that really good as well. And there's a section in Teaching for Mastery by Mark.
It's the plug show.
Who's paying you?
I mean, this is where I learned all my stuff from, and I'm a pretty new teacher, and I found them sources to be really useful.
What do you think? I often talk about education being on cycles and fads and fashions, whatever. What do you think's changed, Bernie? When did you start what you call Singapore maths? Like 15 years ago or something like that?
2006 officially.
So what is it?
14 years ago.
What do you think's changed recently to make, I've been bleating on about this stuff for years and years and years and years. And now there seems to be a zeitgeist for multiple representations and manipulatives.
I don't really know the history of it. I think some of the politicians had an influence on what happened. They tried to push things. Mr. Gove comes to mind. and they just tried to change things. And I think that ended up being a good thing long term, but I'm not sure that they really knew what they were doing at the time when they were trying to change things. But I think it's that drive to try and catch up with these other countries. And that's happening globally. America's changed over to a lot of manipulatives, their curriculum now. So I think it's happening everywhere. Everybody's trying to level up and get up because it's just driven by countries wanting to improve their economy. I think that's where it's come from.
The looking to the Pacific Rim countries.
Yeah. I think it's just driven by economy, which is why the politicians are behind it. But as I know this much about politics, that's probably, I'll stop there. I don't think it was started by educators wanting to move things on.
On that question, Bernie, is there anything that you think is particularly good about the British system that the rest of the world could learn from?
Just a small question.
I knew I'd get caught on this program. Is there anything great about the British system? I'm not a huge fan of the curriculum, and haven't been, which is why we changed over to the Singapore curriculum, because I could a long time ago. There's a lot of great things in there, but I don't think that it's coherent yet. It's going through a lot of transitions, a lot of discussion, a lot of changes. I wish that educators had more influence over what's happening, because what I hear from the back doors, it isn't necessarily that much. Yeah, there are lots of wonderful things. If I say too much on here, I'll get slaughtered. I'm still not happy with the curriculum itself. I don't think it's very well structured. I think it's got lots of holes and problems. But it's improving. That's about as far as I'll commit on that one.
I've got a more specific question from Rebecca Hansen here on the user manipulatives, actually.
I've just lost 300 followers on there. Rebecca, I'll be down to zero by the end of this. Thank you, McCourt. You've stitched me up again.
Rebecca's asking, how do LaSalle use manipulatives to explain division and explore why it is both counting groups and sharing fairly?
And as the inverse of multiplication.
Oh, yeah, there you go. Bernie's just answered it for me. Most people that know what we do know we're pretty big on subtraction being considered as anti-addition and division being multiplication. Subtraction is addition, division is multiplication, and linking it into those things there. So we link multiplication as one single thing and use the field axioms. It tends to be our approach, so that rather than thinking of division, we think of the multiplicative inverse, because then you get into some really interesting discussions about multiplicative relationships. And multiplicative relationships are not very well gripped by pupils in the UK. And what's interesting is not only are they not very well gripped by pupils in the UK, but there has been a significant decline. If you look at data from the 1980s, the mid-1980s, and you look at data from a couple of years ago, there's been a significant decline in the understanding of multiplicative relationships. So the answer is in the same way we do with multiplication, basically. We don't consider division to be an individual thing. But I think what Rebecca's probably getting at is how do we consider division to be different metaphors for different purposes, whether it's grouping or sharing and so on. Yeah. In the same way with multiplication, multiplication might well be almost an additive process. But then multiplication, the one that's missed out a lot is multiplication being considered a stretch, elasticity. That's missed out a heck of a lot. It's in the same way as multiplication is my answer to that.
Yeah, she's got a further comment. Subtraction being anti-division is shown with consistent use of the part-part-whole model, which can be shown with all sorts of different operators. So,
There are times where multiplication, it is helpful and appropriate to consider it as repeated addition. My point is that we mustn't create a structure where children think that is what multiplication is. There are times where it's appropriate to think of division as repeated subtraction, but we mustn't have a system where children think that's what division is. And you find a lot of children who have just one model for multiplication or just one model for division, and they come unstuck later on when those things have to mean something completely different, particularly when you get into generalization and you're doing it algebraically. That gets really hard. I did a thing on Twitter ages ago showing numerals as algebraic expressions and then doing repeated subtraction from an unknown base. And for some reason, it went down really well. People loved it. But that, to me, was an indication of that. That indicates that we're not teaching division in all of its color and diversity in primary school. We're teaching it just as either grouping, sharing, or repeated subtraction.
There's a really good one somebody posted yesterday. I thought I bookmarked it, but I can't find it. It's an ATM article, and it's about looking at division but within fractions, and somebody realizing they'd never really thought about it beyond the pictures and the representations that they had. I can't find it right now, but look out for that. That's a really interesting read.
I think that's the points that Mark's just made about kind of those multiplicative relationships have been kind of echoed in the approaches to teaching GCSE. There's a lot of ratio and proportion in there, and proportionality is ridiculously important as a thread through all of the kind of secondary curriculum. But when you go and speak to any examiners or you go to any of the meetings with any of the exam boards, they're always talking about how poorly those questions are answered. And it maybe is a fact that we need to start earlier showing them those representations, particularly as a stretch. That was something that Gemma Sherwood actually mentioned at Maths Icons a few years ago, and all of us in the room went, oh my God, why have I never drawn it like that before? Because we all know it's true. We all know it when we do similarity, but we've never experienced it as kind of a model of multiplication, and actually showing that might make it at a lot earlier stage, might make it a lot clearer.
Yeah. Nice manipulatives for that are things like double number lines, which were hugely popular in texts in the 60s. Mm. You know, a lot of like Midlands maths program and so on. A lot of those sorts of things included double number lines and exploring elasticity and stretch. But that seems to be quite absent from primary math at the moment. But, you know, now we know why, because Bernie says the curriculum's not good.
Another 200. Go on. I'm dying here. Thank you, Mark.
I think that isn't, you know, that question about UK and what's good about the UK. It's a really weird thing that education is the UK's fifth largest export. That if you take a country like Singapore, for example,
yeah.
Singapore's got about 500 schools, tiny place, tiny country, very easy to control system. But if you take the top 500 performing schools in England, they outperform Singapore, and by quite a considerable margin. Mm. And I often wonder why it is that the rest of the world looks at the UK and thinks they're really good at education. And the UK looks at itself and says, you know, we've got our schools aren't good enough, our teachers aren't good enough, you know, the exams aren't good enough. Actually, they're pretty bloody good internationally. And if we did look at the top 500 performing schools in England and try to emulate some of what they do in the same cultural situation with pupils living in the same society, you know, have the same values, that might be a useful thing to do.
Yeah.
But nobody ever wants to do that. Nobody ever wants to say, actually, there are 500 really good schools in England. Let's see what they're up to. And there's a lovely thing. This data has been replicated many times. I remember Michael Barber writing a summary for when he was at number 10, it might have been, him writing a summary and saying that across school variation, the standards across schools is less than variation within a school.
Yeah, I've read that.
You know, if you take a secondary school that's got 15 maths teachers and you go watch those 15 maths teachers, huge variation. But actually across 15 different secondary schools, they're pretty much the same. So what is it that's going on in those individual classrooms that we can identify, and what is it we can learn from those individual classrooms in England? I think that would be an interesting thing to look at, but no one ever does. And the curriculum's an interesting, the national curriculum for those schools that follow it, which even though many schools say we don't follow it because we're multi-academy trust, most schools do follow it. You know, they have mappings of it. They have close approximations to it. The national curriculum basically hasn't changed since 1989. There's been some tiny reordering of topics, but just reordering. Other than that, there's been very, very, very little change. It's just that we went from having it very extensively supported to not being. I mean, the primary national curriculum looks like a pamphlet now compared to the primary national strategies. But the expectations are not very different at all. Yeah. In terms of content. Anyway, I digress again. I want to hear from Catherine and Ashton about you talking about models and representations and manipulatives and stuff, and that is your sense that in the classroom there is a move towards multiple representations. It's not just like old duffers like us sitting around saying we think these are good things and then nothing's actually happening in the classroom. I always worry about that. People that write about maths education or pontificate about maths education and say, wouldn't this be great? And then nothing happens in the classroom, which, you know.
I think for me, it's quite hard to pinpoint because I did something else before I was a teacher. I've only been teaching for 4 years. And so I feel like I've come into it at the point of the drive of the kind of Singapore, Shanghai maths kind of side of things. And so I don't feel like I've really ever known anything different, but actually from moving to a school where that wasn't my NQT year was in a school that was a maths hub lead school. And so that was very heavily pushed all over the place because there was lots of training. You know, we were using it in lessons all the time. We were adapting it and sharing ideas. And then moving to a school that doesn't use it, I've suddenly realised that actually that isn't a thing that's necessarily in everybody's classroom. You know, for me, trying to train other people and using them is quite a difficult task for people that feel like they don't need them. It's not even just that the kids feel they don't need them. It's that the teachers are like, well, I've taught without this for years. Like, so why do I suddenly need to know how to use counters to teach negative numbers? It's not a thing that I've ever had to do before. But I think that sometimes if you win a couple of them over on something, they then start to develop that for themselves. And for me, it's just been about playing with things and trying things. So my bottom set year 11s were incredibly resistant to things, but then I had everybody in watching them playing around with, you know, all kinds of base 10 blocks and algebra tiles and all kinds of stuff for expanding brackets. And suddenly it felt a little bit more like they might be on side. But obviously it's we've not been there for a while, so who knows what's going to happen when we go back. I'm hoping they feel inspired to read like Pete Maddock's book or maybe do some CPD while they're off. But not everyone is as enthusiastic as I am is what I'm finding as I kind of go through. I feel like I've always been in like this weird little bubble where I've been in like a maths sub central school and then on Twitter and at maths conf, and like everything has felt perfect and like everyone uses manipulatives. Everyone knows how to do this, but most people don't really.
Yeah, I worked recently in a project with an FE college where we were trying to introduce manipulatives to 16 to 19-year-olds and kids who really hadn't enjoyed maths, hadn't been successful with maths. And unfortunately, this COVID business got in the way, but we started getting off the ground and they were really responsive to it. I thought they would be very resistant, and they weren't. They were really into it. And some of them said, why didn't we do this last year? So it's not always too late.
Yeah, I think that's the same with kind of my year 11s, who they felt like they never had any success in maths whatsoever. Mm. And then suddenly I gave them some algebra tiles and they could expand like two binomials, and it blew their minds that something that looked so hard to them, because even one bracket looked ridiculous to them, they could suddenly do two. And it was a nice, I think the fact that people saw that was a nice breakthrough, not just for the kids, but for them.
Yeah. Mm.
I think that kind of what you said, Catherine, that there is a bit of a bubble in some ways. I don't know how many. So, for instance, on Twitter, like it's such a it's gaining lots of popularity, and lots of people are buying into the idea and using it. And but outside of that, I don't know how much it's kind of breaking into teachers' toolkit. I don't know how much the non kind of Twitter community is using it. And I'm only at a small school with two, a maths department of three. So I know, very small. So, and I don't think the other two maths teachers don't really use manipulatives. And I'm not sure that they would and they'd be open to it. But that's kind of me. I'm not sure that I feel like, oh, trying to broach it and persuade people to start using something. I don't quite feel kind of confident to do that as an RQT, I would say. But yeah, so I think it's definitely getting more popular. But I don't think it's definitely not the norm. And I'd say it's probably quite far from the norm.
Got some more things, comments coming in. Great. It's beginning to warm up. Charlotte Hawthorne says, agrees, yeah, there's definitely a move towards manipulatives, but staff and student buy-in is hard. Naveen Rizvi, who will be with us next week, she's got another question, curriculum-based. Is there a country whose national curriculum you really like? I'm not sure who that's towards, but if anyone wants to take that. Barney's ducked.
They're all extremely similar. Extremely similar. There aren't many influential education systems in the world. You know, this is kind of what I used to for a living, if you go back far enough. Where countries would come along and they say, you know, help us with our national system. So if you look across a lot of the world, they have purchased in the consultancy from either the UK, New Zealand, or the USA. They're the three really, really big influencers. So all across the Middle East, for example, basically you had the UK and Australia, the UK and New Zealand competing with each other to win all the national contracts to build the national curricula. And the funny thing about that is the New Zealand and the UK approach is extremely similar anyway. Mm. The USA, when they introduced the Common Core State Standards, which caused an enormous hoo-ha about, you know, we shouldn't be told how to teach as states. The exact same happened with Australia when it introduced its new national curriculum not long ago. The territories said, you know, this is a disgrace, we shouldn't be held to this one national curriculum. But actually, if you analyze what was happening, there wasn't a great deal of difference. Yeah. So Massachusetts is a very high-performing jurisdiction. What it was doing previously in terms of curriculum content, yeah, isn't massively different to the Common Core State Standards, which isn't massively different to the UK national curriculum, which isn't massively different to the Australian national curriculum. Content-wise, it's all very, very similar. One of the things that we have to do at LaSalle is map to different countries. And we did one where we took a mapping for Australia. I went through every single thing. Like, it took ages and ages to go through each granule and work out where's the difference. There was only one difference. That was it. A single granule of difference. Hmm. And that was that in the Australian National Curriculum in mathematics, in grade 4, I think it is, there's a maths objective in the Australian National Curriculum about the specific protection of Australian birds, wildlife, right? So that was the one single difference in there. But everything else is pretty similar. Obviously, it's not the case if you look around the world at a history curriculum or whatever, but everyone's learning fractions, everyone's doing arithmetic, everyone's, you know, they're very, very similar. Statistics is the big outlier. So it's quite unusual that in the UK, statistics is completely embedded into the maths curriculum. That's quite an unusual model worldwide. And most countries have it in other places. But yeah, they're very, very similar in their approach. Singapore is obviously a very interesting model in that it aims for stability. You know, it's on a 10-year cycle. Mm. They're reviewing it over a 10-year period, and then they only make these changes at very, very careful times. So a lot of their success comes from stability, I think, rather than the explicit content of the maths curriculum. And where you see stable systems, you're able to do interesting things. I remember a long time ago, the state of Qatar asked us to do this Education for a New Era program. And we were sort of laying it out, saying this would take 30 years to do this. And they said, okay, do it for 30 years. You just can't imagine that in the UK. You can't imagine saying, let's come up with a really good plan and implement it over 30 years. Or as Singapore does, let's implement this over 10 years. Let's carry out a research project nationwide for 10 years so that we're feeding into the system, reviewing it, and so on. So I would go with content-wise, that there's very, very little difference content-wise around the world. But in terms of stability, I think Singapore is the most impressive system that exists. It's just a really grown-up way to look at education, that we're going to take this seriously. It's a massive countrywide research project. We won't change things in the research cycle. We won't change stuff. And then the research cycle will feed into the next cycle and feed into the next cycle. So from that point of view, Singapore gets my vote.
I'm a huge fan of their early years curriculum. It gives the children the space and the time and the breadth and depth to really get to grips with the foundations of number and mathematics. And they also start, like most places in the world, they start real schooling a little bit later. So the children really have time to develop as people, develop a number, develop everything.
Yeah, that
low and deep.
So the content ends, like I was saying, the content ends up pretty much the same. The starting point, the age starting point, is a really weird thing that the UK, there are other countries, but they are outliers. The UK considering early years to be, you know, just the very, very start. The rest of the world thinks, well, early years is aged up to 7, right?
Right.
So the UK is odd in the way it does that and ignores there is a profound difference in children learning up to around about the age 7, age 8. It's markedly different as to how they learn, the relationships they have to have with the educator, the personal knowledge they have to have of that educator. There's a lot of difference there. And that's not, I don't know if that's a curriculum thing. It's certainly, well, it's not a curriculum content thing.
No.
It's a structural thing. It's an education structure thing. And the fact that we don't have an early years system in the UK, I think harms us a lot. People are always shocked because, yeah, I'm quite fuddy-duddy and geeky about maths. People are always shocked where I say, I wouldn't bother teaching them math until they're 7. Not formally, just let them play with pattern and story and metaphor and let them explore and let them develop, let them become really interested in asking questions and thinking hard, and let them become really curious, you know, instill in them a sense of curiosity, and then they'll accelerate. Whereas I see a lot of 5-year-olds having the curiosity bashed out of them, which I think is a bit of a shame.
Oh. Yeah. On that, I taught, so our school's an all through school, and I did some primary lessons this year. And I remember, I was working with year one, year three, year four, year five, and year six for just one lesson a fortnight, providing some kind of enrichment for them, which was really good, and I really enjoyed it and learned a lot from it. But I remember the first time I had a year one lesson, that was trying to get them to do like structured things and write in the books. It was such a battle, and it was frustrating. It was like they didn't know how. It took them like 20 minutes to write a title. Why do they have to write a title? The you know what I mean? It was I can very much that from that experience, I can very much empathize with the fact that it's too young for them to be doing formal learning.
Got more questions coming in, just follow-ups really. Mr. Busby is asking again, we answered that earlier, what are the best sources of training materials on using manipulatives? And Naveen's got a follow-up question based again on curriculum and what period of time was education most stable in the UK?
Yeah, it hasn't been really.
Mm.
Yeah, even where you have systems of long periods of the same party in government, it hasn't been stable. And so, if you think of the Conservatives coming in 1979 and then going all the way through to 1997 this huge period of one party. It took until 1985 to get the Better Schools paper through. Then the Better Schools paper took another 3 years to become the initial national curriculum document, another year for that to evolve more. We had 20 national curriculum levels in 1989. Then it took another number of years for that to become 10 national curriculums, 8 national curriculum levels. All these big structural things, they matter a lot. They make a big difference. So even when we had a long period of one government, there was very little stability. And then if you think of the 97 to 2010 Labour government, there was stability in terms of the national numeracy strategy, which was started in 1995 under the Conservative government, was continued. And certainly when CFBT ran that contract, it was just a framework and schools could follow that framework. So there was a period there that you might consider to be stable. But once that contract passed to CAPTA, that contract then ballooned and was very unstable. Every year there was another national strategies initiative and another bit bolted onto it, another bit changed. So it's been a really long time since we had any kind of stability. Pre-1989, schools could pretty much, you know, do whatever they wanted to do. So within individual schools, you had a lot of stability, or you had the chance to have a lot of stability. But then you had national diversity and a very, very different offer to different types of pupils. It was an extremely uneven system where some children had an amazing education and some children had a rather abysmal education. 1832 to 1897 was pretty stable. No, I mean, it seriously was. There was the Newcastle Act, but that didn't make a great deal of difference to the national curriculum for maths. But then children only went to school age 10 to age 11. So
yeah.
It was quite easy to make it stable. Or you could stay at age 11, you could stay to age 12 and age 13. And if you did that, if you stayed age 12 and did an extra year of maths, at age 13, you became the teacher, which is easy way to solve the teacher shortage, I think, is we could just convert a load of 13-year-olds to maths teachers. That'd work, wouldn't it?
And if you do the further maths GCSE, then sorted, you just start teaching it in year 7.
Absolutely.
That's how you get the further maths GCSE.
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you think if we got a period of stability where this kind of national curriculum stayed the same, there was less kind of interventions from outside sources, it would make people more invested in doing the things we've been talking about before, so thinking about representation, thinking about curriculum design better? Because for me, it kind of feels like if it's all going to get thrown out every so often, what's the point in investing a year? Like, I've spent a year trying to decide what order I want to teach things in, but if someone's going to throw that out in 3 years time and tell me that I can't use it, it is going to feel kind of pointless. And for me right now, that's not like, it's not my major concern, because I've only done this once. But there are people that will have done this 4 or 5 or 6 times and had it all thrown out, and therefore maybe almost by doing so much change, it's done harm by trying to do good, if that makes sense. Like, changing things for the better hasn't really done that, because people don't get to grips with one thing before the next thing starts.
I think the cycle does an enormous amount of harm. I'd argue the cycle is a 30-year length, so you usually only get to see it twice in your career. But it does do an enormous amount of harm. It's why you see 50-year-old math teachers in schools right now going, oh, so we're doing this again, are we? And then it'll be the next bit, and that'll be the next bit. What I would say, what I tried to do as well, what I would say is try as hard as you possibly can to just do what works and ignore whatever's in fashion. You know, like when Bernie started Singapore Maths in 2006, that couldn't have been less fashionable at a national level, but it works. Yeah. So it's find some head teachers to work with who couldn't give monkeys about the cycle, and just say, maybe we should just always do what works, and stick to that. But yeah, there's a constant fight, people are arguing, this is what we should be doing, this is what we should be doing, and trying to make that swing from one to the other to the other. Yeah, that's depressing, isn't it?
Sorry, it's my fault.
It's Naveen's fault. We'll blame Naveen.
What's that question?
We've got her next week, so we'll blame her. Yeah, again, more questions just coming up on manipulatives. And you know, if you have any questions, get involved. This is your thing. You ask us questions. I'll like stop the speakers and I'll ask your question. It's very important. Yeah, again, so Daniel from Peak Tuition, manipulative related questions. Simply, what would you recommend as your top couple of manipulatives to what's the detail to invest in? Yeah.
Algebra tiles, Dean's blocks in multiple bases, Quisenaire rods, two color counters, geo boards. Is that enough? Did top five. That'd be my top five.
Young children, but they're going to be there anyway, adding unifix or multi-link. They're essential to the beginning of number.
Yeah, Lego's pretty good.
Yeah.
What about Wreck and Wreck, Bernie?
Oh, now you got me. 10 frames and Wreck and Wreck. That's the... Yeah, that's the beginning of number for me. It's one of the key things. So Atul's now holding one up. Thank you. Yeah, I mean, we've worked a lot in Uganda. It's an interesting place to go and try things out. And all of their children counted in ones. In fact, all of the adults counted in ones. Everybody just counted in ones. So if you wanted to do 7 plus 6, they would make 7 marks, 6 marks, and then count them all. And pretty much everybody did that. And using the 5 frames, 10 frames and rec and recs, we managed to move them on over a couple of, it's only weeks really, if you put it all together, to start to developing number sense, to relate numbers to 10, to start thinking beyond one. So those tools are very important. It's Amy Howe, isn't it? I think I'm not good at names, and thank you. Yeah, have a look at her stuff. There's loads of free books on the internet as well on rec and recs, none of which I can remember at all now because I'm old and senile, and that's it. But if you put something on Twitter, I'll send you some links.
Yeah, ask us again on Twitter. I'm hoping to get Amy on. I'm still convincing her to come to one of these things and give us a little demo. Another question from Charlotte Hawthorne. Why are there so many different schemes of work and so many also making their own?
Guilty, sorry.
Why is it you feel the need to do that, Catherine? Because you're writing one now, aren't you?
I think we've looked at lots of different ones and none of them quite fitted with what we wanted for our context. And so we've kind of just amalgamated lots of ideas from lots of things we like and tried to pull together something that makes sense for our students, is what we thought based on what we know about our feeder schools and the way that we teach. So that was kind of the thought process behind it. I wouldn't say it's unique, but for me, I guess, there's a bit of me that's like probably very like you, like loves that kind of interconnectivity of the whole thing. And so it was an opportunity for me to explore that and see how we can better communicate that to the students. And it's almost like teaching somebody else's lesson in some ways, that I found it quite hard to see that interconnectivity where somebody else had designed it. And so I kind of just drew on lots of different places to find something that was a fit for me, a fit for our team, and a fit for our kids. It's probably not massively revolutionary, and it's probably not hugely different to a lot of things that are out there. And it's a very, very small scale version of what you've been working on. But a lot of the things that you've done at LaSalle have kind of inspired the way of thinking for our specific setting.
What about you, Ashton? What's curriculum design like at your school?
So we're changing our scheme of work this coming year, which I know you're a big fan of, and I think I'm all right in believing that you think it's a very productive use of teacher time. But the reason why we're doing that is because we are an all-through school, and primary have been working on the White Rose scheme of work for a while. It's kind of a continuity thing. That is a scheme that goes from six mm-hmm. to 16. So in that sense, it makes sense in our context for us to change. And we'll tweak it and tweak little bits accordingly. But it's kind of, that's the basis of our scheme of work next year.
Yeah.
You look really mad at us, Mark.
No. I think I've designed loads of curricula over the years here and other countries. And it's one of the most fascinating things I've done in my career, is design curricula. And I really like it. I'd consider myself to be a curriculum designer, and that to be a part of the skill set I've built over the years. Having done that many times, I look back at curricula I designed 20 years ago and think, that was pretty dodgy.
Do you think it can help develop teachers' understanding of the curriculum, though?
Yeah.
Like, sitting down and doing it at least once, this makes sense because of this, and this makes sense because of that. And I think that that is quite a productive process.
I think, learning about curriculum design is a very good thing to do. Doing curriculum design, no. I think that, 350,000 maths teachers, I think there are a bunch of those people there that want to do curriculum design, and that's where they want to take their careers, and that's great. Let's do that. And, like Catherine's saying, she finds it useful. Well, I'm not going to call you a geek, Catherine, but you did say a bit like me.
I am very geeky. I will accept it.
So, if you have that geeky interest in doing it and you find it fascinating and you want it to be a part of your career and your career path and what it is you learn, and you want to specialize in that, I think it's a great thing to do. I'm so glad that that's what I chose to specialize in, was kind of curriculum design, because it is fascinating to do. But I don't think we should expect 350,000 maths teachers to all want to specialize in the same thing. And I think that, I was talking about Singapore earlier as being, I said it was kind of like a grown-up way of approaching it, because as a country, they try and solve the problem together. They try and solve the single problem. Well, if there's 350,000 maths teachers, which is about right, maybe 1,000 of them or 5,000 of them or whatever are, like Catherine and I, really into it. Well, that's a big, strong cohort of people who could work continuously on improving, testing out, working on these things, and then share it with the rest of the profession. What I struggle with is the notion that it is a healthy or useful thing to ask 25,000 schools to design their own curricula. I struggle with that. You would be very lucky if you're in the school and you've got someone like Catherine who's really into it. You're very lucky, right? Because there's someone who's doing all that thinking, being really careful about it, thinking deeply about connections and how this builds, progresses. But that won't be the majority of schools. The majority of schools will be full, maybe their head of maths or maybe a maths teacher, they're thinking, the thing I really love is task design, or the thing I really love is assessment design, or the thing I really love is pedagogic choice, or whatever it is, and I want to pursue those things. And I just think grown-up professions would allow that. They'd say, Catherine would be able to say, I've got your back on curriculum, right? Or the 1,000 of teachers, the 5,000 teachers, whoever they are, we've got your back on that bit. Here's all the knowledge, we're going to share all of it with you, and you can draw on that. Maybe if we had a national program like that, where everyone's contributing to this who wants to, and they're building it up and they're researching it and taking it really carefully, maybe that would even inspire more people to get interested in curriculum design, because they'd have an extremely high quality curriculum to play around with and explore and not have to do the grunt work. I remember being, when I was a head of maths, actually, when I first became a teacher, I was very lucky to land in a school where the guy who was the head of maths over maybe 30 years had developed this curriculum and everyone followed it. And he ignored the national curriculum and all that. We just followed this amazing curriculum that he developed. And I remember as an entrant into it thinking, well, that's perfectly natural. You wouldn't expect me to design my lessons, to plan a curriculum, to design assessments, because I've only been teaching a day. It would be insane to expect me to have the level of knowledge that you have. And what will happen is I'll build that knowledge up by using these materials. And I just think it's the mark of a profession that we draw on all of the knowledge inside that profession and utilize it properly. Yeah, as I've said many times, there are just no heart surgeons in training being told, come up with your own way of doing it. That'll be a smart thing to do. Instead, what happens is the profession says, over what have we been? We've been doing this 180 years, right? It's not very long. The school system in England's not very old. So we've not been doing it very long. But it's long enough that we've taught many, many, many millions of children, many, many millions of lessons with millions of teachers. That's a big canon. That's a huge knowledge base. And we're really bad at institutional knowledge. It's also one of the reasons education is maybe the most ageist profession that I know of. It's everything. I've got to invent a new wheel all the time, constantly, instead of saying, hey, that grumpy guy who's 55 that works down the corridor, he's taught tens of thousands of lessons. You might know something. You know, it's that idea that in our profession we should always reinvent the wheel, I think, is not good. And people position this as teacher empowerment. They say you should be empowered to think about your setting, your pupils, your staff, you know, you should be empowered to do that. Well, yeah, but that's not the same as saying, and you need to do an enormous admin task to make it happen. If you have a really good curriculum, if you have a really good national picture, national view of what's going on, like they do in Singapore, the teacher, the classroom teacher, can think about pedagogic choice. Yeah. They can role play that lesson. They can think about how it's going to unfold, what I'm going to do with children. When this arises, how will I react? They can think about subject-specific pedagogic choices, because all the burden of the profession has been lifted from them. We're all in it together, all helping each other out. And I would like to see a system where the Catherines and the me of the world can say, I'm going to dedicate my time to that. I'm going to put tons of effort into that, to the national picture, the national, repository of knowledge. So that's what I'm going to chip in. And then someone else says, and the thing I'm going to chip in is, I've worked doggedly and determinedly on working out the best models and metaphors and examples for teaching early year fractions, whatever it is, right? And I'm going to throw that in. And I've dedicated 30 years to making sure this has been tried and tested. I'm going to throw that into the pot. So I'm not in the least angry at anyone. I quite
like that idea of kind of having a whole bunch of people dedicated to the same element of the profession, because for me, kind of, it all matters. But for me, it felt like if it wasn't sequenced right, you can't get the teaching right. And so it was the place I wanted to start, because that little like maths and teaching geek in me kind of wanted all the maths to make sense as much as possible. And it wanted all of the teaching to be really easy and fluid and everything to interleave really nicely. But after, kind of, to keep on top of that and to keep looking after that forever is a massive task. Whereas there is a member of our department who literally is obsessed with creating differentiated like questions, like and doing all of that side of things and actually being able to say, well, you be part of that task force, I'll do this bit. But if you can then make stuff that fits with this, that'd be lovely, is kind of, it's a very nice model. I feel like it'll work on a very small scale in my school, but it would be nice to feel like you would be part of something like that nationally, I think.
I really do believe it can work. It's why you guys might have heard me say at MathsCons that 350,000 maths teachers, imagine if we all knew each other. Could you imagine if we all were chipping in to the same repository, the same knowledge base, helping each other out? It would be phenomenal. This profession could be amazing. I really do think it can work. It's why, you know, I've been having this argument with governments for decades, and it's why a few years ago we said we're just going to stop having the argument and do it. We're going to go off, squirrel away, and get on with building that community and getting people to know each other and getting people to chip into the same thing. Because I think it would be very, very powerful. And then you have all the, you don't get the cycle then, you see. If you involve everyone, and everyone's chipping in their thoughts and ideas, the cycle goes away, because the fighting goes away, because then people can just elegantly argue for the reason I think this model works here is because, and I tried this with this many thousands of children over these decades, and this was the outcome, and this is how I tweaked it. And yeah, it could be really quite amazing. I can't remember what the question was now.
Yeah, we've got a few more related questions coming in. It's great. It's fantastic. It's starting off lots of conversations.
Before you carry on, I am going to have to go because I'm joining a secondary mastery specialist webinar in 5 minutes' time. But it was very nice to speak to you all, and I hope we get to do it again another time.
I am also doing that, so maybe
see you there, Ashton.
So maybe see you there. Brilliant.
Thank you so much for joining us at short notice. Thank you very much, Ashton.
See you later.
Ashton,
yeah. Bye. Thank you.
How to leave? There we are.
Oh, crikey! The whole screen's changing.
Oh.
That's fine. I'll just readjust that on my live stream screen. No, it works. That's cool. And then there were three. Okay. Bharti Karadia on Twitter also asking, any suggestions on how to adapt scheme of works for when we return back to school?
Yeah, I mean, I wrote about this recently, that what's coming up is just, I don't know, this is going to be the biggest challenge we've faced for a really long time as a profession. Depending on when schools go back and what that gap ends up being, we're going to have to really pull out the stops and lift everyone back up to where they should have been, or even beyond where they should have been. So I think there's a lot to do with supplementary education. There's a lot to do with accelerated, you know, making sure we're working out which gaps have appeared in that time. Hugely, hugely complex. Really is. Some of the schools we're working with, we're saying, oh, so you've got your curriculum, and alongside that can be supplementary mathematical curriculum that's designed deliberately to lift pupils up from the gap they were at. It's such a hard question, and I don't think anyone yet has got their head around what the solution to this is going to be. Sutton Trust and also some encouraging noises from government. Sutton Trust are arguing that particularly those children who are disadvantaged, that there needs to be some ongoing thing. So what we're doing at LaSalle is we're running this disadvantaged pupils tuition. And we've trialed that. It's happening at the moment. What we're going to do is over the summer run daily maths lessons that you can dip in and out of, and hopefully lift up as many pupils as we can. And that will continue for at least 15 months. So that will be this supplementary educational course happening alongside their school experience. So that's our proposal, but we only have capacity for maybe 5,000 pupils. Places like Southern Trust, and certainly encouraging, there are lots of encouraging noises at DfE at the moment around how might we solve that. People will have heard things like making sure children have the technology, making sure they have access to the internet and so on, so that they can use these supplementary courses. But as we talked about a couple of weeks ago, Atul, that the technology is often the smallest part of the problem.
Yeah.
You know, it's, do I have somewhere safe and quiet where I can learn? And do I have the time in my day? And, you know, these are going to be massive issues that take us maybe years to undo. I saw the figures yesterday or the day before, was it? About the disadvantage gap that the last month or so could have undone the last 10 years. You know, that's the sort of scale of problem that we're at the moment. I don't have the solution. I don't think anyone does know the answer to the question yet. We all just keep working on it.
Yeah, on everyone's minds, really. I've got another one from Philip Walker related to stuff you do. The drive to embed the mastery philosophy into UK Ed. Question one, how far are we into that project?
That's tough, really. Not very far would be the answer. You know, that if you want to take a mastery approach and truly work with it, that's quite a big shift in current practice. And I don't think there's a lot of schools that have moved in that direction yet. There's the national program, the NCETM run, and they, you know, the, what was that, 70, 74 million pounds, I think, something like that, 74, 75 million pounds. And they've massively, massively under-recruited. It's supposed to, that 74 million was supposed to pay for 8,000 schools to take part. As of the winter, I think they were only at 5,500. Which, yeah, is still a good number. And it's definitely been spoken about more than it has ever been spoken about. And there's definitely a desire to move in that direction, particularly primary schools. Whenever I talk to primary head teachers, they always mention it. They were always talking about moving in that direction. But realistically, on the ground, we're a very long way away from getting to a place where the UK is implementing at scale a mastery approach. So not very much is the answer to that.
Right. Just another, I suppose, scheme of, got Kay Kurtz on Twitter as well. What do you think of the White Rose math scheme?
I never comment on competitor products, ever.
That's fair enough. Let's see, what else have we got?
You can ask Murray.
Yes.
No, I agree with Mark, yes. Well, I do some work for AUP, so it wouldn't really be my place to say anything. Next question?
Yeah, it's going through my feed. I think this one's related, yeah, again, from Rebecca Hansen about community and teachers talking to each other. It's called a co-production. Is much easier in the social media age, but it still needs wise leadership to happen.
It is... On the face of it, that makes a load of sense, right? That, and if you look across other industries, it's also being borne out that there's much more collaboration, there's much more co-production. It removes logistical problems. It makes those kind of thing that Rebecca's talking about, those co-production initiatives, easy, you know, across lots of other industries. You know, my other expertise would be the pharmaceutical industry, and you see it happening there all the time. But
education is different.
Education is very different, yeah. And here's the really weird thing that we used to have, as teachers of a certain age will remember, we used to have two really important initiatives. The first one was the local authority teacher centres. And you had people in the local authority that were responsible for mathematics. And one of the things, so they were the inspectors before Ofsted, local inspectors. One of the things they did, one of the things they were remitted with doing, was bringing together maths teachers regularly, the maths person, right? And they were pretty good at doing that. They were pretty good at bringing together maths teachers really, really regularly, maybe once every half term. And the other one we had was the Nuffield Teacher Centres.
Mm.
And they did the same thing. So they brought together math teachers very regularly to talk about pedagogy, to talk about practice, to talk about curriculum design, all sorts of stuff. So a while back, you know, in the 80s, it was commonplace for a huge proportion of the profession to come together regularly. Now, they were doing it locally, So they weren't coming together as a national group, but they were coming together a lot locally. And then all that was dismantled. All that's gone. National Strategies did something similar. All that was dismantled. And now we have Twitter and social media. And there is a proportion, but it is a tiny, tiny proportion of maths teachers who are on Twitter. And then it's a smaller proportion of those who are actively engaged in the conversation. So I sometimes worry that the technology is lulling us into a false sense of security, thinking all maths teachers are talking together and all maths teachers are co-producing. And actually, I think co-production is much lower now than it was when the Nuffield centers and the LA centers existed. But yeah, obviously I take Rebecca's point that the technology is there and it would be possible, and there are lots of people doing interesting things. But I don't think we've really gripped it as a profession. I don't think we've gripped that opportunity to work together in that way.
Yeah, I feel it's still a bit of a bubble what we do, you know, going to those maths confs, this Twitter community, these Facebook groups that I'm a part of. And just to go back to one of those earlier questions on how much our manipulate is being used across the UK, not a lot actually, because I get a sampling of 2Ts all over the UK, and one of the first things I ask them, primary or secondary, is do you use any of this stuff? And like almost no one says we've used algebra tiles. It's the first time they hear about it. Or Quizenaire odds. And I've asked primary students and they said, oh, we use stuff like that in preschool or something like that, you know, like they haven't used them at all since preschool. So this is at primary. So you know, we know it's great we're doing all of this, and I do hope it spreads and we can form the corporate action. But yeah, it is still very much of a bubble. Yeah, I feel.
Yeah, I don't know why. Why is it that other industries, other sectors have gripped the opportunity that the technology affords, but that education hasn't? I don't know why that's the case. A lot of, yeah, when I speak to people about this, people talk about, you hear weird words said in teaching that you don't hear in other industries. People will talk about feeling exposed, worried about being told off. You don't hear that in other industries where, you know, a professional doesn't say, I'm worried that my employer will tell me off. It just doesn't really happen. But there's something about teaching, something about that sector where the individuals in it feel quite vulnerable, and exposing your thoughts online is, you know, that's very difficult for a lot of people to do. Whereas you look at other sectors and people say, I think this is true, and then the other people in our sectors go, you know, maybe, maybe not, maybe we should discuss it. In education, you might see someone on Twitter and they say, I think this is true. And then suddenly, boom, a load of people jump on them and say, you hate children. You know, what a terrible thing to say. So, I know, it's a weird thing. People are quite worried about talking about what they do in this profession.
Depressing.
It's not meant to be depressing. We're talking, so that's okay.
Yeah, it's great. Exactly, you know, it's this is the first step for I've been in, sort of involved in music quite a while, but you know, we were using Periscope about 10 years ago, this kind of stuff. So you know, it's only now the situation's forced, I've kind of brought it to the fore because I'm used to online things, online teaching. But I've seen it come up in the software development world and tech, and lots of stuff like this. There's a lot of, a hell of a lot of co-production going on there, like Wiki, the ideas of Wiki. Wiki thing, Wiki that. Okay, well, the comments have slowed down, so I think we've had a really nice run. If there any kind of parting shots from either one of you, while we finish up, and there will be another one next week. We have the lovely Naveen Rizvi and Gemma Sherwood with us. I'm hoping to do these every Thursday actually, so until school start up, or I'm used to this technology, so I think it's a fantastic way of connecting, getting conversations started. We already have a network on Twitter. We can draw in other people. So is there anything you'd like to add while we...
It's education is so important, and for children, they get one shot at this. And it's a shame that as a country, we can't come up with a model somewhere, I keep banging on about Singapore, but where they have set out a roadmap, set out a plan, and stayed with it, and just changed as we go along. We keep swinging this way, we keep swinging that way, and our children are suffering from that. And the teachers are left trying to grapple things together, and everybody's making their own thing. It's just doesn't work when you compare it to other countries. It's heartbreaking.
Yeah, I can't beat that for a closing remark.
It's very sad.
Yeah, but the opportunity is there. The goodwill is there.
Oh yeah, no.
And
the teachers are magnificent.
Yeah, so maybe it's hopeful. Yeah. There is hope to bring about that kind of long-termism is what we need in education. Yeah. Good. Okay.
Yeah, and fantastic. I mean, this is—it's been a really good collection of, all of us, active in the classroom, young and old. And this is, it's a start, and I hope more of us are able to tune in. And this is the kind of consistency I'd like to give it on the Thursdays, and when schools start up, I'm prepared to live stream, use social media as our tool. It might. Just encourage more and more people to join in. Hopefully we spread the word, and we take a pragmatic and positive approach to all of these things. And I suppose the young ones are here are sort of optimistic, foolishly optimistic perhaps, but we run with it. Let's add what we can to this system. Fantastic. Thanks for your time again, Bernie and Mark McCourt, and your first group live stream, I believe, Bernie, so first of many.
Yeah, and last probably.
Right. Thanks very much, Hatton.
Okay. Great. I'll end the live stream first. And